The Digital CMO Podcast is brought to you by Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing, sales, and podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm.
When you hear about content marketing and the companies who are really on the vanguard, there's a few names that always come up. You always hear about GoPro and the amazing video they're doing. You hear about Marriott that's practically become its own media company. IKEA is always in the mix. And they always, you know, they get a lot of the headlines and they win the big awards. When I was at Content Marketing World this year and they were naming the Content Marketer of the Year, all those companies were in the mix. But it turned out that the winner of that group was somebody working on behalf of Wake Forest Innovations, Vishal Khanna. And Vishal not only was the winner of that award in a strange twist of fate, he's one of my high school classmates, and we'd lost touch with each other over the years. And we have him today to talk about what he's done, how he did it, and what's coming up. Welcome, Vishal.
And Mike, thanks so much for having me here. We should also mention that you are my editor of the high school journal that I wrote for, too. So we had a business relationship, too, way back then.
That's right, we did, and I'm very proud that some big names, including you, have come out of that. We were talking about that a little bit before the show started. Two of the top editors at IGN, Steve Butts and Tal Blevins. I guess Tal wasn't in that class, but Steve was. So it was a very high achieving group of people.
Well, those guys are characters, definitely. Actually another student, I think it was a year younger than us, was Mac Rogers, who actually just wrote the script for The Message, which is the new GE podcast. So we're all over the marketing world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, no. In fact, as we were gearing up for the podcast, I was really looking at that GE one as a great example of content marketing. So that came out of Greensboro, too.
Indeed.
Well, and you've got, you know, given that at Content Marketing World, they're tending to have big comedians now, like they had John Cleese and Nick Offerman last year. They need to have our other fellow classmate, Ken Jeong, maybe join next year, because he's both good on social and from Greensboro as well. So Greensboro is the epicenter of the content marketing world. We're going to declare it right now.
I think it is. You know, don't forget that Pace Communications is based out of Greensboro as well, and they're one of the big, you know, content marketing agencies, and really in the world, too. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, they're really one of the first ones. I used to think of them as an in-flight magazine company, but they probably are one of the original content marketing agencies and one that definitely everybody looks at. It is a small, small world. So we're going to get into your story and some of the amazing results that you drove at Wake Forest. But before that, I wanted us to talk a little bit about 2016, or at that part of the year where it's impossible to do any kind of podcast or blog and not prognosticate about what's going to happen in the year to come. So 2015, I think, was obviously a big year for content marketing. It was a year where programmatic advertising really dominated a lot of the discussion in marketing. What are some things that you see or you hope to see as we run up here into the new year?
Well, you know, I think like one of the things I'd like to see the most, and I hope to see, is a shift in business structure where marketing, and especially digital marketing, which is, you know, they're one and the same nowadays, enters the table of product development or service development a lot earlier than we do now. So, you know, even in my group, most of the time, we don't enter the conversation of our products until they're already completed. And then we come in and we strategize on how to promote that product or service. And what I'd like to see, and I think, you know, we're seeing it in our group, and I think a lot of other folks are starting to do this, is marketing coming into the table and actually playing a role in product development as well. And you know, we have a very distinct point of view coming from the trade that we all practice, where, you know, if you start thinking about how you're going to sell this product as you begin developing it, you may have a lot more value in your actual marketing processes. So for me, that's probably the biggest thing I'd like to see. I think one other feature that I think we'll see more and more of in the future is that marketing is going to expand into a little bit more of the customer experience. So, you know, a customer has 1,000 touch points with any company or brand, whether it's a small one like mine or, you know, a massive one like GE. And for marketing to be able to control the touch, the tone, the cadence of all of these communications and touch points, I think we're going to see that expansion happen too.
So when you say that you're going to have more control over those touch points, how much of that is dependent on marketers both having access to and a command of the overused big data or lots of intel on the individual in order to customize that experience?
I think there's a twofold thing. So one, that would be helpful, but I don't think access to data and access to the persona of the client is as important as establishing a tone that sort of relates across each touch point. So, for example, you know, if you have a tone that's very sort of lighthearted, and, you know, think about MailChimp and what they do with their various touch points. It's a very lighthearted, playful tone. And if you have that and all of a sudden it breaks in an email that comes to you as a response to you signing up for a service, there's not that continuity of brand through all the touch points. So it's not necessarily, I don't think, that you need the to understand who that persona is on the other side as much as ensuring your voice is always the same through the customer experience process.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's something that people are getting more and more aggressive with. I just the other day got an email from Simple. You know, it's the online bank. And I had I got an account and put $5 in there just because when they started, just because I wanted to see how it worked. I believe BBVA later bought them. But they sent the annual update to the privacy policy in terms of service, which nothing could be more off tone in general than getting a bunch of legalese thrown at you. And they actually wrote it as a comedy piece, and it was riveting. It was really, really fun.
That's right.
And I mean, I feel like that's kind of the final frontier. When you start bringing the company voice and brand and tone into the legalese, then you've really created an immersive environment that customers appreciate. I've never read a credit card or a bank account terms of service before, and I did the other day when I got that. So I think, yeah, you're right. I think we will see a lot of that. You know, I'm seeing companies that are really almost building around voice almost more as the differentiator than service. I don't know if they have it in North Carolina yet, but out here in Texas, and I know it started in New York, there's this Oscar. It's a health insurance company. And they're, you know, they're trying to portray themselves as, you know, health insurance shouldn't be hard. It should be easy. It should be a good experience. It's, you know, making you healthy, and very much. I don't know that they've differentiated in product that much, but the voice just is so clear and so refreshingly different from anything else you see. So I think you're onto something there, and I'm seeing a lot of companies try and do that, particularly in undifferentiated markets.
You know, I think, though, at the same time, you know, and especially for smaller companies where you have a little more control over how the company functions, you know, I don't think you would see it in the massive brands as much. But as we develop these tones that we have, you have to back it. You have to actually be what you're speaking. And I think that's important. So, for example, you know, we were speaking about MailChimp and their sort of very lighthearted feel. If the company were actually, I don't know, a cutthroat mortgage company trying to foreclose on you, that's not going to work well. You know what I mean? So there has to be a level of, even though the word is already becoming overused, there has to be a connection of authenticity, I think, between the tone of the brand and the actual company, their services, all the way down to how they treat their own employees, because that's all part of a larger ecosystem of voice. You're not the only one who owns the voice of your brand. Every action you take also creates that voice.
Right, and every employee and every touch point with a customer, and even if you sometimes the way your customer advocates behave, I mean, reflects. We see that a lot when we're doing reputation management. Sometimes it's the avid customers that create problems in voice, and obviously you can't control them, but you can lead them by being consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing you said I thought was cool, and it tied very closely. It actually was a step further than one of the trends that I was going to touch on that I saw was, you know, making marketing integral to the development of the product. And I think that is indeed the holy grail and what we want to see. I think at least what I'm seeing with some of the bigger companies we work with is that even within marketing, we've had these siloed channels, and there's, you know, there's social and there's SEO and SEM, and there's direct mail, and there's display, and there's outdoor, and as much as people pay lip service to synergies, they really are siloed and don't talk to each other. And I'm starting to see the de-siloing of those channels, so that at least that when they're at the table, they're playing from the same playbook instead of just reading a report and then all trying as best they can to do the same thing. I'm starting to see folks make that a more integral process, which I think is a big step along the way to what you're suggesting, which is they need to be at the table when you're deciding what are we taking to market.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's essential. I mean, you know, if we want to build products that resonate with our end users, we've got to have multiple analyses of them. And you know, I think that the trait that we practice can deliver a lot to how the story of that product is going to be developed. And the earlier we get in the game, the better.
Very cool. Very cool. So anything else big you're looking for in 2016?
I have my one wish for 2016 is that companies stop outsourcing content writing to India. That would be my preference, because you can tell every time they do it, you know, because the writing has a very specific tone and cadence to it. And it's blatantly aware, you know, that a company went for a low-cost alternative. And I think, you know, especially content marketing world, I think we heard this again and again, it's not about quantity, it's about quality. And, you know, hopefully folks will, the ones who have let go of that embrace will re-embrace it this coming year. You know, quality is what converts, not quantity.
Couldn't agree more. And I'm really surprised how often I still run across copy that is clearly outsourced. And it's not a matter even of where geographically, but you know, it's just that sort of brokered copy where people say, I'll write anything for, you know, a penny a word. And you can really tell that there's not been any thought behind it, and they're just trying to get the keywords in. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, keyword, keyword, verb, keyword, and not something any human being would want to read. And I'm just shocked at how prevalent it still is. You know, the stat I keep hearing is about how 90% of the world's data has been created in the past year or two. And I've got to think that a third of that is crummy content that is, you know, got to be filtered now.
Yeah. The writer Haruki Murakami called this stuff years ago in a book he wrote, he called it cultural snow. And it's these words that you write and you throw out there, and they melt and they disappear. They don't have a lasting impact. And I think that's what we're dealing with a lot, where you know, numbered lists, for example, are written solely to you know, gain traffic, but that traffic doesn't necessarily convert, and it's not necessarily valuable in that way. You know, I do freelance work as well, and I have a client who has this one page that performs amazingly. It gets a third of the traffic of the entire site, but the page barely converts. And so it doesn't matter that you get a lot of traffic. If you're running a business that's based on selling a product or a service, what matters is that the percentage of traffic that converts. And, you know, that's a philosophy we hold dear in really every strategy we have here.
Yeah, you know, that is the thing that I think marketers are still having a hard time getting over, is the easy but meaningless win in a metric. You know, it can be the number of page views. It can be in social. It's how many likes did I get? And not that you don't want an audience, but when they talk about, you know, I want to have 1 million likes. Well, would you rather have 1 million likes, or would you rather have 100,000 that are customers? And you have the same thing really in terms of getting people to a page versus getting people to convert. And it's frustrating because there's still a lot of companies and you would think very sophisticated marketers who I think are just so intent on having a big up and to the right graph, and the layup is that entry into the funnel, the visit to the web page, the like, and when really it should be more of a long-term view and one that looks at conversions. I couldn't agree more.
Well, I think your phrase long-term is the biggest challenge. And I think every single one of us, especially who work for larger organizations or companies, face this. The level of patience you need for long-term strategies sometimes is not there. And so when you're planning, like every job in a big company has, you plan your goals and your milestones and you define what you're going to report to your higher-ups, because we have to think short-term as well, a short-term solution is always traffic. We can work traffic. We can make additional traffic happen, and then we can report that and get our accolades. Patience, and maybe it's patience from the C-suite, but patience is essential for what we do. And I think the data show it again and again. You need a year of doing this before you're going to really see results when you implement a content marketing program. You don't get it right away.
Right, you don't get it right away, especially if you didn't already have a program or you've got baggage that you're bringing in with the brand. I mean, the way we tend to portray it to folks when they're starting with us is we've got to go out and play defense first and make sure that we're creating enough good content to drown out the either bad or indifferent content that was out there, and we've got to then draw an audience and get them engaged. And then in year two, let's start playing offense and really converting those people to customers. And the average one will say, yes, that's absolutely great. And then they call 30 days later and say, hey, I don't have any leads this month.
Yeah.
That's where you start as a marketer just banging your head against the wall, because you know that it's somebody higher up in the C-suite that came down and said to them, we just started this work. Where's the results? It's a big mind set shift. When we were at Content Marketing World, Robert Rose spoke a bit about that you can't treat this as campaigns. You can't think of it as I'm running a blog post that's a campaign, and at the end of 30 days I'm going to see what it did for me. Mm-hmm. Because at that point it's just you got to measure it almost just like branding or nothing, and it doesn't really tell the real story. At least that's what I've mm-hmm. seen. Is that what you've seen?
Absolutely. I think I'm guilty of running campaigns. I'm running 4 campaigns right now that are all about 40 days long. And so I'm as guilty of it as anyone else. And I think what's funny is, even as I'm doing it, and I was in a meeting with my team today and we were just talking about it, I said, I don't even think this is going to work, but I'm going to try it anyways and just see what happens on the other side. And I think we do it almost out of practice. We've been doing this strategy for so long that to shift into a longer term point of view when you have, say, a sales team on the other side, I literally have my sales team on the other side of my office wall, who need your leads, there's a push to try to give quick solutions. We can't help it. We're in the nature of business that works at a pace that doesn't necessarily always have patience for the longer term strategies. And so I think, what then becomes worthy is, almost doing with your left arm, doing the longer term one, and with your right arm, doing some quick solutions to, keep everyone happy as you build a larger program in the background.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I was going to say that's what we find sometimes with new folks, is that we have to find one piece of the strategy that will give you some sort of positive blip and a beacon of hope fast, and then use that to buy the capital to do the bigger plan.
Yeah, I think it matters how hungry your salespeople are too. That can define the pressure you have as well. If you've got a hungry sales force, I think they're going to be willing to take and work harder with the leads you give them. And what that means is, if you have a variable on the spectrum where you say, okay, this is a marketing qualified lead and I'm ready to pass it on to sales, that's not a line drawn in concrete. It can be anywhere on the spectrum. And a lot of what we do is we base it on the hunger of our salespeople and what they have. So if they have time and they need to close deals, we bring that point down a little bit. We use Pardot, so we use engagement points. This is a 50 points is our standard one. We might bring it down to 30 for a week to give them extra leads to work with and work. So I think if you have that flexibility, that helps as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great segue to our next segment. We're going to take a little break here, and then we're going to come back and talk about it specifically the work you did at Wake Forest Innovations. And one of the hallmarks of that is how it tied very closely to what the sales teams were doing. So we will have more of that when we come back with the Digital CMO Podcast.
This is Rainmaker FM, the Digital Marketing Podcast Network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at rainmakerplatform.com.
So we're back here on the Digital CMO Podcast with Vishal Khanna. Vishal has done a lot of work with a number of different companies, including work with Wake Forest Innovations, which was honored with the Content Marketer of the Year award this year. And that's not just soft, fluffy, they did interesting stuff. Some of the stats I've seen cited a 600% increase in web-based qualified leads, a 183% increase in interactions as a result of responsive email design and marketing efforts, double in trade show traffic, and the holy grail for any marketer, a 100% increase in revenue. Some pretty amazing numbers. So, Vishal, will you tell us first, what is Wake Forest Innovations, and then how did you pull off those kind of results?
Sure. Well, you know, Wake Forest Innovations is the B2B arm for Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, which is a top 50 academic medical center made up of a hospital as well as a school of medicine. And as such, we have faculty who are involved in clinical practices, your surgeons, your general practitioners, your anesthesiologists, and so on. But we also have clinicians as well as researchers who are involved in things such as drug development, developing and testing medical devices, coming up with new diagnostic tests, new vaccines, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the environment we're in now, especially for academics involved in science, is quite different than it was, say, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, you know, if you were submitting a grant to the NIH and you got a score of, say, 20 or 25, and a score of 1 is the highest, you probably would get funded, and you would be funded, and your research team would be funded, and you'd be able to do your work. Well, you know, it's a lot more competitive now, and the number has gone down from 20 or 30 to sometimes you have to be in the top 5%, get a score of 5. And that becomes quite difficult for a lot of folks out there who are doing phenomenal work. So the answer that this institution and similar institutions across the country and the world have come up with, and it's just a few of us doing this right now, is to develop your own B2B arm and to really sort of put in a robust sales and marketing and product development group inside of the institution as an entrepreneurship function. And that's what Wake Forest Innovations is. So, you know, at its core, we really manage three different business units. The first is technologies for license. And so when I say that, that's if a faculty member comes up with a new medical device to improve anesthesia care, or what we would call the holy grail in our space, a new cancer therapeutic. Our group helps them develop those technologies, helps them figure out how to take it from idea and ideation to actually developing something that can finally be in patients. And we also do the sales component. We market and we sell these technologies to industry, to the buyers in the pharmaceutical and medical device industries that are interested in it. That's business unit one. Business unit two is the promotion of our research services. So, you know, at this institution, we have 1,100 faculty, many of whom are internationally renowned in their specialty. These are very well-known folks in their industry. And what we're doing is opening them up to partner with folks in pharmaceutical and medical device companies. When those people are developing their drugs and their devices, we then help them by testing and assessing how they work in preclinical and clinical models. And so my job is to promote those research services, promote the technologies, build the stories around all of these things. And then finally, the last one is immersive and applied and hands-on training. It's a very smaller part of at least our marketing space, but a key component of our organization. And these are trainings that physicians need to take to keep up with the latest trends in healthcare and specifically clinical healthcare. So those are my three business units. And then just for the heck of it, out of the blue, we also do digital marketing and communications for a physical location called Wake Forest Innovation Quarter. It's a innovation hub and district, about 150 acres in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And you've got, you know, academic groups, big data companies, advertising agencies, startups, all of those sort of groups are inside of this space. And, you know, our job is to use digital to create a community for this place. So that is something completely different than everything else I do. That involves, you know, promoting bands in a park downtown as opposed to, you know, promoting a new anti-cancer drug. So a little bit of, right. little bit of confusion sometimes that we face here as we switch from one to the other, but it keeps things interesting.
Well, and when you talk about the type of biotechnology and medical kind of early stage stuff that you're talking about, helping along, great marketing is in that space is not something that typically pops to mind. How did it come to be that you had such a robust marketing effort for this type of industry?
This university bet on us. And I think that's the biggest thing. We had a backing of the university that gave us the space to be creative and break some rules that they might have had otherwise. But more importantly, sort of steal from other, and not steal, borrow, be inspired by other industries that do this kind of stuff well and try to translate it into our space of academia and the biotech world. I was also lucky enough when I first started here to be, working under a gentleman named Tom Clarkson. Tom's one of those unsung heroes in marketing who's been doing this stuff since the 80s, and he's been involved with really almost every major software company since then. And, I got to work under him and learned a lot of good techniques and strategies. At the core, though, you know, we were, all of us, especially at the beginning, myself and the sales team, we were really excited to do something new, and that helped a lot. To be able to create something that hadn't been created before, that really kept us motivated.
When you say you looked at other industries for cues because you didn't really have role models in this space, what industries did you find were the most transferable as you were trying to make your plan?
Well, you know, I think when we talk about marketing, especially digital marketing, you know, for me at least, a lot of the best companies to look for are the companies that make digital marketing products. The folks who are willing to use them themselves and seeing how they do things had been a lot of the model for us. Before I started here at Innovations, I also worked in a couple of software startup companies. And so we were doing this kind of work there, even back in the early 2000s, you know, in a very raw and rough way, we were using content to try to drive conversions. Probably mostly the software space was where we borrowed a lot of our strategies from. Those guys were doing fantastic work.
Okay.
And it's so, very B2B oriented too.
Right. And B2B obviously plays very differently than B2C. And I think sometimes people try and railroad B2C tactics in and they don't really work. So getting into what you did, I know there's a lot of content creation and you laid out your different almost verticals, your different business units there. And one thing you did that I thought was interesting because I've seen people do it exactly the opposite and the way you did it is you created a different site for each one. You didn't just have one master site with the content. Can you talk a little bit about what the thinking was there and do you still think that was the right way to go?
Sure. So just to let you know, that strategy was in place before I got here. So I walked in the middle of those sites being launched, really. But I can tell you the thinking behind that. And the thinking behind that was an SEO game, really. You know, building these detailed and micro sites and getting them content heavy for their very distinct target audiences. You know, the sites we have, they all have different audiences. They don't really, there's not much of a crossover. Even though biotech is a small space, there's not that much of a crossover between them. And so I think that was the justification and the thinking behind these sites originally. I'll tell you, SEO from the beginning has always been the best performer out of all of our strategies as well. So whatever, you know, the thinking was, it absolutely worked because SEO is delivering. There's definitely some negatives to it. And I think the biggest one is sometimes when you have multiple sites, you lose a little bit of your brand power in that, not having a single, you know, entity that you're pushing each time with every single thing. So some of that is lost in what we do. And I think there's a little bit more of a workload involved because you're managing multiple sites, even though you're not necessarily creating additional content. You have more sites to manage at a purely technical level. Now, that being said, you know, our sites share the same code set, which makes a lot of our work much easier in the background.
Right, right. You said that, you know, SEO is a key, and it's really, you know, you're using content to drive organic results. Did you also supplement that with paid media, SEM, any kind of targeted programmatic, or was this a purely organic play?
Absolutely. Yeah, we do and did a lot of Google AdWords advertisements, as well as LinkedIn targeted ads and sponsored updates. Both of those performed average. You know, if you look at performance rates, SEO's at top, trade shows next, and then emails come after that. So, you know, AdWords was not a good strategy for us. And I think it's just the nature of our audience that wasn't giving them what they needed, A, and B, we were getting a lot of folks who weren't necessarily buyers who were clicking through and engaging with those pieces of content via AdWords. So you didn't get that sort of narrowness that you need. And because our target audience is extremely narrow, a broad brush like Google AdWords just ain't going to pull it off for what we do. You know, if I were in a different business or selling a product that was more mass-oriented, I think it would be a completely different story. But for us, right, it's essential to get really, really narrow. And I think you and I were talking about this before the podcast. You know, there are times where we'll actually have a target audience and we'll build a full program around it for 20 or 30 people. For us, the reason it's valuable to do that, create all this content, you know, generate emails, push it out, do follow-up, is because one sale of, you know, in this target population could be worth, you know, $400,000 to $500,000. And so our investment is very much worth it when you talk about the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was saying that, you know, I almost relish those assignments where we have a very small addressable audience, because you can get crazy targeted and know that you're at least going to get a shot at them. And one of the tactics for that is, and you mentioned using LinkedIn, and I'm very bullish on LinkedIn. And I know, I mean, here on Rainmaker FM, there's a whole podcast dedicated to LinkedIn. And I think it's the sleeping giant in the B2B space in terms of targeting. How did that work for you?
I mean, I got to tell you, I love LinkedIn, and I love it because of how narrow you can get in your targeting. I can get down to pretty much, you know, in my target audiences, maybe, I don't know, one out of every five fit the match of my buyers, which for me is pretty good. And I'm quite happy with that number.
Right, right. You did a lot of video in your storytelling on these sites. And I noticed some of it was really, really long form. And I know it goes against a little bit the traditional wisdom of short form, but I think it makes sense in this space. Can you talk about how you used video and what the strategies were there?
Sure. So a lot of what we were doing was, I should precurse this by saying, giving you just a taste of sort of the landscape of who are, you know, experts are and who they speak to on the other side. So from the beginning, it's always been our goal to get a scientist-to-scientist conversation. That's what leads to a sale in this space. I'm not a scientist, but I work with scientists, and my sole goal, as my counterparts in sales are, is to make that relationship happen with the academic scientist and the scientist that works at the pharma or biotech company. And as such, there's a different way you speak to scientists than you might speak to other populations. There's a little more patience because they have some academic lean to them. Even the ones in industry still have that. It's part of their trade and their craft. So you can take a little more time, and they'll engage with you when it's a topic of interest. And when we did these original videos, you know, they're about, most of them averaged about three and a half minutes or so. We did that for that distinct purpose, to give that longer in-depth feel, almost as a sort of description of the product for sale, the technology for sale. And the reality is, when you do that and you're speaking about a complex technology, it's going to take a bit of time to get the science right. And for our target audience, you got to get the science right. More than anything else, if you make a mistake on the science and you don't present yourself as the true experts in that space, then that's a major negative.
Right. Before the break, we talked about how marketing, how tightly you're integrating with sales, and how even their hunger for leads at a given time may dictate your tactics. Can you talk a little bit about the deep integration with sales here, particularly given that I think you said your number two channel after organic SEO was trade shows, and obviously that's a sales-driven effort. So I see so many times where marketing and sales are disjointed. How did you get the two working hand-in-hand, and how did that affect your campaigns?
Well, I think, you know, we had one advantage starting off, that all of us came on at the same time. So right after this organization was built, sales and marketing were pretty much, we were all hired about the same time. So we all joined together in the spring and summer of 2013. And as such, we were all building something fresh together. And so there's a level of camaraderie, I think, that helped. And, you know, my sales team were also just fantastic people, so I wanted to befriend them. But there was definitely a shared pathway across the board, and we've all agreed that we only have one very distinct goal that's a shared goal. You know, just because I get a marketing qualified lead to you doesn't mean anything. It's about the sale at the end. And because we're all focused on that metric internally, and that's what we report on more than anything else, we sort of keep in the same line. We have regular meetings all the time. You know, we're literally, my sales team is right next to me. So marketing and sales are all in the same area, physical area as well. And because we work with scientists and researchers, you know, we regularly sort of engage with our product experts together as well. And so, you know, in a lot of cases, when I'm say preparing some marketing materials, I might actually bring one of my salespeople with me or ask them to join me, because they understand the science in a lot of cases better than I. You know, a lot of our salespeople come from the biotech industry, and so they have a distinct knowledge of the industry. Especially when you get to the technology side and not just the research services side, you know, everybody that works in quote unquote sales on the technology side, I think all of them but one has a PhD. So, I mean, these are scientists doing sales as well, which adds to the help. And I think finally, these are folks who didn't historically have marketing support. So before, you know, we came along, the people doing this kind of work didn't have anyone doing marketing to help them. And so they were pretty happy to have us along, actually. And that's been pretty easy, is to have that. But, you know, key for long term is showing your value and continually delivering on whatever that value is.
Right. Right. Well, it sounds like obviously with PhD sales people, you've got domain expertise. And I know that you said in the first segment, talked about how you're not a fan of outsourcing overseas content. I would imagine for the content you're creating here, you really had to have some domain expertise. How did you find your writers?
Well, you know, that was our biggest challenge. And we couldn't even outsource keyword development. I mean, that's the level where we had to keep everything in-house. You know, it helps that I've got a master's in public health, so I have an academic background in healthcare, and I've worked in the healthcare space for about 10 or 15 years. So I've got a good experience in here, and I understand science enough and can sort of translate it out pretty easily. Finding the writers involved training the writers. You know, I tried out a lot of different writers the first year I was here. You know, it was really difficult to get good ones. I finally found one who had some experience doing similar work for Georgia Tech, and she was helpful. But what I found in the end was that the strategy we sort of ended up in was pulling all of our various freelancers together into a single freelancer, bringing her in-house, so she's here most of the time. I think the writer's here about 25 or 30 hours a week, and spending 3 months training her to get the right voice and the right sort of strategy we wanted to have. So a lot of it is just you bring a person in and you spend 2 or 3 months training them and then let them go off and, you know, do what they're great at.
Right. So it's very much like being a domain expert for an industry publication. You can't fake it. You can't bring in a generalist and hope that they can figure out the science. And it sounds like you were in a case of, you know, you had to grow your own.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we've trained everybody pretty, you know, and it's a small handful of writers here now. I think we have three we use now, with one of them being doing most of the work. You have to train people how to write the way your brand wants to. And one of our requirements was understanding science and being able to speak to scientists. So that becomes the requirement of the writer.
Right. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the industry, a lot of pieces written about the great success you had. Obviously, no one could know that if you didn't measure it. How did you build measurement into the process? And can you kind of walk us through how that sales funnel works, where you go from I've created a piece of content to eventually someday in the future, we've made a sale?
Sure. I'll tell you what we had was good. What we're building is probably better, mainly because the technology has gotten better even in the past couple of years. But during the time that we were reporting this, we had an engine really built with a sort of three key components. There was MailChimp for email, Pardot for automation and measurement, and Salesforce for the sort of sales lifecycle campaigns, et cetera. We use a lot of other ancillary tools as well, you know, things like Raven to measure keywords and technical proficiency on the site. We use Yoast for SEO. So we had a handful of tools that we put into place. You know, for a small group like us, technology was really the saving grace because it enabled us to do a lot more than we could have done otherwise. But as such, you know, MailChimp was really built to engage with audiences that hadn't yet been privy to our brand or any content or hadn't been, you know, opted in a very traditional fashion. And then when the person engages, we bring them into Pardot and we would run them through various sort of programs of engagement, measuring it all the way across the way. And when a person hit a certain threshold, they'd move over to Salesforce and our sales team. And then that process would be measured through a series of steps. It took us to build this, it probably took us a good 8 months to get it, you know, with sales and marketing really partnering together, especially on the Salesforce side, to get it to work exactly as we wanted it to. You know, I'm a data geek, so doing that was probably the most fun out of my job, you know, and just building all the connections and being able to see almost in real time, you know, what's going on our sites and who's engaging and who's not. I mean, it's fantastic. You know, even if you just think 5 years back, you know, a group like mine and the budget we had would never be able to do anything at this level of complexity.
Well, right. And it does get to the point where you want to just sit and look at the dashboard because you can say not only, ooh, there's another one. I mean, that's what it was like in the 90s on your website, right? It was like, ooh, I just got another hit. But now you can say, ooh, I just got another PhD candidate from Massachusetts who spent an hour and 20 minutes on the site and, you know, go on from there and probably follow him and know what he ate for dinner. It gets pretty heady.
That's funny. Except for the students, we never paid attention to. They don't
oh, really?
Spend money.
Well, right. Exactly. So that's a good question because you create a resource, and we see that a lot of times when we create for a client, and you get in the audience that they want, but then you get an audience that aren't buyers but are ancillary, like students. And I'm sure you mm-hmm. can probably justify, well, those students are future buyers. But did you find them interacting in a way that at all, you know, took time away from your sales efforts? As you know, sometimes we've seen where you get the wrong audience in and they start sending you a lot of email and asking you a lot of questions, and you have to find clever ways to filter out the wrong interactions. Was that an issue for you?
It continues to be an issue to some extent, not necessarily with students per se, but, you know, because we're rather unique in what we do, we're not a traditional company, you know, we don't necessarily do run-of-the-mill projects, and we're not really a good fit for people just looking for a standard study, like, here's my drug, go test it, and give me the results like I told you to. You know, what the right marriage of relationships between us and a pharmaceutical company usually sounds something a little more like, well, we've got this drug, and we think it's going to work, and we think we understand how it's working, but we don't totally get the processes, and we'd like you to do an investigative study to give us a better understanding for how this drug functions inside of a person. And at that level, that's when we really are a good match. And that's an extreme challenge. To find that perfect match is pretty difficult sometimes, mainly because in the space we have, if you're in a company, you know, companies usually don't have that many projects going on that they're going to need. And when you narrow it down further and say, how many need an investigative study in this very distinct niche that you have, say, I don't know, pain research or substance abuse research or research on certain hormones in the body, which is what you talk about when you talk about academic scientists, they have a very narrow expertise in a lot of cases. they're the best in the world at it, but it's extremely narrow. Finding the right match between the two is probably one of the biggest challenges. And we continue to look for any creative way we can get to really engage the right person and make that right connection.
Right. Well, you obviously you made a lot of those connections. You had a lot of success with the program, and I'm sure that the next question is always, well, what now? What have you done for me lately? What are the next steps for you?
Well, you know, there's two sort of big things on RQ that keep me interested, at least. And, you know, we sort of doubled down on digital in an interesting way. We brought in a new director of marketing communications who is very digital friendly as well. And, you know, I was already in this space. And so everybody's sort of using digital as our core channel now more than ever. And so as such, we're doubling down on content as well. We're just introducing a new technology, Curata. Actually, as we speak, we're working with them to do some customizations to match what we need. And that's part of the sort of digital engine that we're building. So my biggest project is expanding this digital engine to really be able to measure to a more minute level the effect of each piece of content on revenue. And then to be able to control what kind of content we really put our minimal energy to. You know, we're a limited set of people, so the more we can do with a smaller group, the better. And then we also have a new site for our flagship brand that we're going to launch probably right after the New Year's, which we affectionately call the Beast with 1,000 Landing Pages. And the philosophy behind that was really focused on taking the majority of our site and really giving each page one of three goals and letting it only have that single goal and not being confused by multiple goals. You are either there just to establish the brand, and we only have a few pages that do that, or you're directional, you're just, you know, sending a person to the next page, or you're a landing page. And so, you know, our site is made up of maybe 95% of the site are landing pages. And when we launch it, I think it's going to be valuable because it gives us the ability to be extremely nimble and agile in how we market, you know, this academic medical center's assets, which are sometimes change pretty regularly based on faculty members' time, expertise, and availability. And so we're able to sort of toggle on or off programs, or we will be at least, pretty quickly and effectively once this gets up. Something with a team of, you know, just three people is absolutely essential to be able to manage the workload and be able to do that. So for me, I'm pretty excited about that site. And, it definitely is a storytelling site. It's built to share content. It's built to engage. It's built to convert. So hopefully it will do exactly all those things.
That's cool. It's funny you say 95% landing pages. One of the things we try and preach is every page is a landing page at some level. And I feel like some sites or some businesses will try and create, okay, I've got two landing pages for my key audiences, and then I'm going to just put up a bunch of content on the other pages and pray. But it sounds like you have much more of a strategy there. It's much more refined.
Well, you know, I mean, I think for us especially, why do we have, you know, you have to ask yourself, why do you have a website? Why are you doing this? And if your answer, and which is probably the answer for most B2B people, is to get new clients and build revenue, then your site should focus on that as its primary goal and not establishing a brand or speaking about who you are. You know, because ultimately who you are is not as relevant to your potential client as what are they going to get out of this relationship. And so we really start, you know, as I think a lot of folks do, we start with the persona and what the persona needs. And the site is about them, not about us. And I think that'll help that out.
Yeah. Wait, given how niche you are, do you have a lot of different personas, or is it pretty much one solid persona that you're aiming at?
We have like, I don't know, four or five master personas that we work with, you know, and so we keep it general. And then when you're down in the various niches, they'll usually just borrow from one of the master personas. And it's just, you know, it's as simple as, you know, buyers in the medical device space looking for services, buyers in the pharma space looking for services, investors, you know, things like that, you know, or the sort of larger buckets or categories of people. And then within that, you know, you can narrow down to the types of people you're actually looking at. And, you know, we have these buckets, and then we fill the buckets with contacts based on, you know, research we do trying to match the right person with our services.
Right. Right. Well, we've only got a few more minutes, and I have a couple sort of sideline fun things to ask about. I love your Twitter handle for a content marketer. It's Be Discontent. How did you come to that? Are you really discontent?
I mean, I always have been. So probably. I don't know. I really, you know, part of it was I just really liked the sound of discontent marketing. I thought it was just a nice little pun, but it was too long for Twitter, so I went with Be Discontent. I don't know. In my head, I think my discontentment with the state of things, wherever they are, helped me be more productive. You know, when I say I'm discontent, what it means is that let's make something new, you know, because if things aren't working exactly as we want to know, let's go build something new. And I think that's sort of the driving idea behind being discontent or malcontent sometimes.
Cool. And then one thing I'm trying to start as a regular feature of the show, I think both because it's interesting who people know and then also it'll help us get the right people on. Can you think of two people you know in the marketing space that we should ask to be guests on the show?
Sure. I think right away, Ardith Albee is someone you absolutely need on your show, especially when you're focusing on B2B and especially personas, because she's probably one of the world's experts in that space, definitely by far. Who else? Mike Oren. That guy's fantastic.
I'm not going to do the episode where I interview myself for at least 6 months.
No. All right. That's when you jump the shark, right?
Or there's a show with Patrick Stewart, Blunt Talk on Stars, where he's this horrible heavy right-wing TV talk show host, and he gets in huge trouble with the law, and he finally decides to get himself out of it by doing an episode where he interviews himself, and he films himself asking the questions, and he does a good enough job where he's like interrupting himself and throwing hard balls. I'm not doing that for a long time.
Perfect.
All right. Well, Vishal, I thank you. I can't think of a better guest for our first show out. We will be here week in and week out on the Rainmaker.fm network. And thank you so very much for joining us, my friend.
Mike, thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Yeah, cool.